We've been studying mostly from Exodus thus far. The journey from Egypt to Canaan, and we've seen about 22 messages on the beginning of the Exodus and 12 messages on the Ten Commandments and the pre and post of that. But we've tried to make this practical and make sure that you're thinking these things through. We're going to be facing a interesting area of our text in the next few weeks as we look at God in our midst, because from Exodus 25 throughout all of Leviticus and part of Numbers, the Bible talks about the tabernacle where God was in the midst of his people. Now, I could tell you this is what everything means and how you're supposed to believe. That's called indoctrination, and that's how a lot of preachers and teachers work. They say, this is the truth, 1, 2, 3, spit it back up on a test, and you'll get an A. But that doesn't teach us how to learn, how to gather truth. It just teaches us facts. And sometimes, especially with our teens, as they get older, they get tired of being told, this is what you have to do. And so they rebel against the church like that. They say, we don't want indoctrination. We want education. We want to learn what is truth. We want to learn the process, not the product. How to think, not just what to think. And so whether it's your teacher or your parents, and especially if it's your pastor, you don't do things because I say this is what you have to do or this is what you have to believe, because I've never been proven yet, but I may be wrong, and and if I am, I'll never admit it, but we need to conform our thinking into his thinking as we look at the tabernacle. We're going to look this week at the history of it and how it was built and its overlay. We handed out a little flyer here to you. Next week, we're going to look at the items, the altar and the ark and things like that that are involved there and how they picture our redemption. And then on Christmas Eve, the third message of God in our midst is going to be just, you know how it is. We always sing a lot of songs on our Christmas Eve service. And we'll be singing a lot, but we're going to focus a little bit on Jesus in the tabernacle, how we see Jesus in the tent, how we see Jesus in the altar, and Jesus even in the curtains around it. And so we'll take a little breather, or two or three, in between our singing on that Sunday. So that's what's ahead. You say, well, is this that important? 1,500 years before Jesus was born, God instructed Moses to make this tabernacle, this tent of meeting, where he would teach about his redemption, where they could offer sacrifices, find forgiveness of sin, and so forth. Theologically, the tabernacle's of immense proportion. In Genesis, only 5 words are given to the creation of the universe after God made the sun. And that, if you look in Genesis 1:16, it says, he made the stars also. 5 words. How many billions of stars and nebulae and all the other things out there in the entire universe? Science can't even gather the end of the universe there. And yet, for the tabernacle in its construction and its function, the offerings and sacrifices made and so forth, it isn't 5 words, it's 50 chapters. There is more taught in the Bible about the tabernacle than about any other subject except Jesus Christ himself. So, I say that to justify why we've got a few messages on the tabernacle and why this is not just some dumb old tent from the Old Testament that we don't need to worry about today. because there are lots of lessons and truths about it. We want to look at the conception here of what the tabernacle is and look at it overall. Then we're going to look at two passages of Scripture that deal with its command and construction in the at this kind of this introduction to the tabernacle, get the view of it. The tabernacle was conceived as a place where God meets man, a place of holiness, a place where God could be in a tangible sense, although remember, obviously, God is omnipresent. He is everywhere. But a place where, though he would not live in the tabernacle, it would be a place where his presence was, and the Jews could see him, as it were, especially leading in the wilderness. They had followed God's presence in the pillar of cloud and pillar of fire. It had led them across the Red Sea. It had led them through the Sinai wilderness area down to the plains at the base of Mount Sinai. And then they saw it resting on top of the mountain in the smoke and fire and lightning and the voice of God. And now he says, I want you to build a tabernacle, and my presence will be there. When it leaves, you'll see it go. You'll see the cloud go up and off, and you better follow it, because that's the direction I'm leading you in, this pillar of cloud and fire. And they did that for the next 38 and a half years as they journeyed through the wilderness. It led them all the way to the promised land. And then it continued on forever. So God has met with man. God met with man in the first tabernacle called Eden. He made a garden where he could meet with man and have this fellowship. And in the cool of the day, God would walk with Adam and Eve. I cannot get my mind around that one. There's lots of things in the Bible that are just hard to grasp. But the thought of Adam and Eve just walking through the garden and chit-chatting with God and talking about what he was going to name these different animals and what he was going to name the trees and the vegetation and so forth. And it's amazing picture there. God had met with the patriarchs as they built altars in the land. He'd met with the Jews in Egypt. And now in the wilderness, he's meeting with them. But this isn't the end, because he's going to continue meeting, having a meeting place, that's a tabernacle, with the Jews as they build a temple under Solomon, as they rebuild it under Ezra and Haggai, in the Messiah himself and in the church today. Didn't Jesus say where two or three are gathered together, what? I'm there meeting with you, right? So Jesus is here. Say hi. See, it's hard to get our mind around all of that. And in the new heavens and the new earth, if you go to the end of Revelation, chapter 21, it says, you know, that the old heaven and earth had fled away and a new one was created, and God was dwelling with man forever. Phenomenal. This is a place. This is what God wants. He wanted that with Adam. He's going to get it in Revelation at the end. But in the meantime, God has used different methods. But for a huge amount of time, God used the tabernacle as this place. It was a special tent of meeting, not just a place where God met man, but a place where this was built, especially every part of it, to focus on God meeting with man. And we see here that in 40 years in the wilderness and then 430 years in Canaan until the temple was built, the tabernacle was this place. It was at Kadesh most of the years of the wandering in the wilderness. It was then at Shiloh and at Shechem and Gilgal, and then eventually moved to Jerusalem and under King David, and finally destroyed as the temple was built in that place. There are five words that help us to understand how this temporary aspect of the tabernacle. They're all used here in Exodus as they talk about, first of all, it's a mikdah, a sacred place. It's often called the sanctuary. We use that term yet today, don't we? We talk about the church sanctuary. I used to always tell my kids to quit running in church, right? Because this is where God lives, and we come by once a week to visit him. And so we've got, well, I didn't explain it quite like that, but the idea of sanctuary, where it's a holy place. It's an ohel. It's a tent. This was not going to be a permanent building. This was not going to be a temple, but just not only a sacred place, but a tent, meaning it's also called the tent of meeting, the ohel moed, which is the idea of the place where man would come to meet God, to offer a sacrifice for sin, to follow the law in what it is. It's called the miskan, which is the word to settle down or put down roots. And this is the most common word that's translated tabernacle in the King James Bible. And then the miskan hadat, the tabernacle of testimony, that it's this tent, this place where they settle down, where God says, this is where I'm at. This is my place. The tabernacle was unique. It was unique because it was just temporary. It wasn't permanent. There was nothing in there that couldn't be torn down in 2 hours' time, put on carts or on the back, and moved down the road and then reassembled. It was not large. We think of the tabernacle of the wilderness, and I put some dimensions up here on the board just to help you recognize. The outer was just a curtain layer, 7 foot, almost 7 foot span between posts, and a curtain hung between them, and it went around 150 feet by 75 feet. Now, think about that. What is 150 feet by 75 feet today? In Casper, what is it?
A city lot.
Yeah, a city lot. Mine isn't quite that big. I think it would take two of our lots to be that way, because my house sits on the lot, but it's not very big at all. And the actual tent, the actual tabernacle that they went into was only 15 by 45. I thought, that's not very big at all. Now, somebody do the math. How many square feet is 15 by 45? Dun, 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 dun. About. Somebody help me out. 600, 670 square feet, somewhere around there. Okay. How? Oh, yeah. See, now I diverted your attention. You're like the little kid that we knew that had the attention deficit problem, and he'd say, okay, what's this number? And he'd go, you know, 2 plus 2. Oh, a squirrel! You know, it would go, you know, focus in there. Okay, now get back with me. The whole square footage of the tent is 650 square feet. How many square feet are in this room? Over 1,000. 15 feet from the wall comes right about here. That's 15 feet. Okay? By 45 feet, well, this is only about 30, but you get the idea. That's the size that we're looking at. So there was actually more square footage in this meeting room than in the tent of meeting in the tabernacle in the wilderness. So it was temporary. It was very humble and unassuming. When people looked at it, they went, oh, a tent. No big Gothic cathedral ceiling, no stained glass windows, I'm afraid. Just plain boards covered over with cloth or gold. But it was a tabernacle. It was a place where God chose to be in a very humble setting. It was a place for the true worship, where the tablets of the Ten Commandments written on them, the pot of manna, the rod that budded of Aaron, were put inside a chest that would be, again, about the size of your coffee table, Okay? That's the Ark of the Covenant and the mercy seat on top of it. We'll focus a little more next week on the different items that, like that, because it's amazing. We develop visuals from childhood and everything looks so big, and in reality, this is pretty small. For Vacation Bible School a number of years ago, one of the Baptist churches here in town asked me for some advice. They were going to study the tabernacle. I thought, oh, wow, that should be really interesting to second graders and third graders and try to do it. And the pastor said, what we're going to do is we're going to build it. We've got a side yard of our church that's big enough that we can build the tabernacle. Now, they used leftover World War II canvas, so it wasn't quite as beautiful. They used PVC pipes to make everything, including the candlestick. And they wanted me to check it out, make sure it was authentic. Well, I smile about that. But the idea, it was a walk-through picture where the children could walk right through and get the feel of what it was, how they worship God back in another generation. Okay, now, Exodus 25 is where we're going to study. We're already in part two of our message. It's the longer part. Part two, the tabernacle commanded. Exodus chapter 25, we're going to be reading some verses here. And we have a number of verses listed in your notes, both online and in your bulletin. And you can have them for future reference. The tabernacle was to be a place of giving, a place where the people could sacrifice and give. Now you see why I like to preach on this. I told you I'm never going to preach on tithing because that's not part of the New Testament church. But the principle of giving, free will offerings, that's a principle that comes from Eden on through the end of time. We read in Exodus 25, verse 1, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, tell the sons of Israel to raise a contribution for me. From every man whose heart moves him, you shall raise my contribution. While Moses is up on Mount Sinai, he said, go down, tell the people, if God moved your heart, give. By the way, isn't that the best way to give? If God moves your heart and you see it, you got to be careful today because we have all these scams that are out there. I think every day of the week I'll get phone calls from somebody or other that wants to give money, and they'll start in on this little memorized spiel, and I'll try to stop them, and they either won't stop or they're a tape-recorded message. It sounds like a real person. And they're just, la 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 la, oh, you got to give. Or you see the picture of the little child and holding an empty bowl and their faces all, you know, tears coming down and everything. It looks like my kids when I discipline them. But the idea is that they try to tug at your heartstrings. But God says, if I have moved your heart, give. Seven times we list the verses from Exodus 25 and 27 and or 6 and 7. Seven times God said to Moses, build it after the pattern I'm giving you and tell the people to give a free will offering. The Hebrew word terumah is a word offering, which means to give part of what you have for some special holy work. We do that as we give to the Lord here in our church, as we give to our missionaries, as we give to other good deeds. And it can include the sacrifices that they were to give, or money, even produce they could give. I remember one dear lady that had emigrated from Germany in my very first church, and she just loved it when I came by her house to visit, and she'd take me out in her garden, and she'd show me my plants. And I'd say, well, what do you mean? This is my plant. She said, yeah, see that cabbage there that's growing in this row? She had a whole row of cabbages. She'd say, that's yours, because I planted that first so it would come to be the first fruit. And God says, I need to give that to the Lord, and you're the closest thing. I brought that up as an illustration in a sermon in the fall when it was deer hunting season about tithing venison and things like that, you know, giving a moose roast to the Lord. And said, the Lord isn't here, but I am? You know, okay. They didn't buy that either. 2 Corinthians 9, verses 6 and 7 says, Paul stops and is talking about giving and says, the point is this. Whoever sows sparingly will reap sparingly. Whoever sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. Each one must give as he's decided in his heart, not reluctantly, not under compulsion, for God loves, and the Greek word cheerful is the word hilarious. Literally, it's hilarious, that's the word. He wants us to be happy. He wants us to give until he has to tell us to stop. We're giving too much. That's the New Testament application of this right here. Men could do it. Women could do it. They could work in the giving the offerings. They could work in the preparation and the building of the tabernacle. All the different things. They could use their skills. They could use the finest materials. God says it might look simple. It might be a basic structure. But it's a place that represents me and my holiness. And so I want you to give your best. Not like we learned in the Navy. One of the first things we learned there is that, you know, do it, get it done, move on to the next thing so you don't get yelled at or whatever. And the phrase that was always used by my friends was, it's good enough for who it's for. You know, Uncle Sam. Well, God's saying, I want you to give, and it's good enough for who it's for, and it's for the Lord. So it better be the best. It better be good. It better be the greatest that you could do. You see, that's the proper attitude we should have. This should be the way, the lesson we learned from the tabernacle, number one, is that we give abundantly, that we see God's great blessing. You see, the tabernacle didn't begin with a hammer or a chisel or a tape measure. It began with an offering plate. It began with people who said, we want to give. We recognize this is what it is. When Alexander the Great died, he commanded that he be entombed, and then, you know, they would bring his body out so that his troops could mourn him as it passed by. But he says, I want my shroud to show my hands, that my hands are open and empty, because I'm taking nothing with me to eternity. Rabbis teach still today that little children come into the world with their hands, they're clenched, because they want stuff. And you've seen that with the little baby, newborn, you know, they're just shaking and searching, grabbing something. But when we die, our hands are stretched out or crossed or whatever it might be there. People with the right heart would know the power and the glory and the holiness of God, the God who had led them through the plagues of Egypt, had guided them across the Red Sea and through months of journey down to Sinai, and now given them the Ten Commandments. And so over and over again in Exodus chapter 35, 5, he says, whoever has a generous heart, let him give. Exodus 35, 21, everyone whose heart is stirred has stirred him. Everyone whose spirit has moved him. And they brought the Lord's contribution. Exodus 35, 22, all who were of a willing heart. I could stop right here. Don't say amen. I could stop right here on the tabernacle and say, this is the first and most important truth. Before we build a place for God, before we have a place where we meet, God says, I want your heart to be right. I want to move your heart. Every person that I ever tell about our church, when they say, you know, the first thing they say is, where's your church? And I say, it's over by Outback and Applebee's. And they go, oh, how big is it? And I always tell them it's 60 by 128. And, you know, wow, that's a huge church. And I say, yeah, it's four floors. It's amazing. But and a swimming pool. biggest baptistry in town. And then we explain We started in the home and outgrew that and moved to another home and outgrew that. And now we're meeting in the meeting room here. And they said, and if you outgrow that, will you ever build a building? No. Because we can give money to such wonderful projects and needs of the world. We don't need that. God doesn't live in a tabernacle made with hands today. He lives in our hearts. He lives in our midst. And he wants our hearts to be right with him. Keep reading Exodus 25, verse 3. This is a contribution that you should raise from them. Nothing big here. Gold, silver, bronze, blue and purple and scarlet material, fine linen, goat hair, ram skins dyed red, porpoise skins. I'll get back to that in a minute. Some might have badger skins if you have one of the older translations. They didn't have badgers in that area. Acacia wood, oil for lighting, spices for anointing, incense, fragrance, onyx stones, and other setting stones. We can go on. This is fulfilled in detail. This is the prophecy of, or the command in Exodus 25. You go to Exodus 35, I won't go because it repeats a lot of this. But Ithamar, the son of Aaron, recorded the giving. People don't just give and not get it recorded. That's supposed to be, you know, make sure that it's every penny, every farthing, every shekel. That's what they have here. Every shekel is a contribution here. Because money is a great temptation. You know, it's like the preacher that was talking about sending money to the mission field. And he told the congregation, he said, I am thrilled. He said, we set $5,000 as a goal. He said, we have $5,000. That's the good news. We have it. The bad news is it's still in your wallet and your purse. And you need to give it. But the idea is that they're a wonderful contribution. Just look through that list real quick here. Precious metals, gold, silver, bronze, 1.25 tons of gold, 4.25 tons of silver, 4 tons of bronze. By the way, yeah, 1.25 tons of gold. You want a visual? Help you get a picture of it? If you take a gold bar and you put it in the back of my pickup truck and you cover the floor and then you cover another layer, and that's 1.25 tons of gold. Remember, all the gold that has ever been mined in history, every ounce that's ever been mined, you could go over to the football field and you could start putting gold bars down on the football field from the goal line to the goal line, from the sideline to the sideline, and you would not get up to your waist high. And that field of gold would be all the gold that has ever been in the history of the world. It's that rare and that precious. And by the way, Jacob, are you trying to pan gold over there in South Pass City? Okay, we've talked about that as a hobby. That sounds like a fun thing to do. Anyway, all this. He dyed weaving materials of the finest yarn dyed from the herbs and from the shellfish of the Mediterranean and so forth. Covering material, fine linen and skins of animals like ram's hair and then an outer covering that would be weatherproof for this 15 by 45 foot tabernacle that is built there. Special hardwood, acacia wood, for durability, oils and spices and precious stones. Well, look at, you know, skip on down to Exodus 36, verse 3. Yeah, that's a few pages. Do it. Exodus 36, verse 3. They received from Moses all the contribution that the people of Israel had brought for doing the work of the sanctuary. They continued bringing him freewill offerings every morning, so that all the craftsmen who were doing every sort of task in the sanctuary came, each from the task that he was doing, and said to Moses, "The people bring much more than enough for doing the work that the Lord has commanded us to do." So Moses gave a command, and the word was proclaimed throughout the camp Let no man or woman do anything more for the contribution to the sanctuary. In this way, the people were restrained from bringing, for the material that they had was sufficient to do all the work and more. I find that just a wonderful testimony of the grace of God at work. Because I am concerned. I grew up in a generation that every penny counted. I carried a little coin purse in my pocket. Yes, I'm a man. A little coin purse. And I'd put pennies and nickels in there. And a great day would be when I found a penny or a nickel or something on the ground. And I'd put it in there because I had holes in my pocket and I didn't want to lose that penny or that nickel. Everything meant something. And so even today, folks, I have enough money to live. I'm very happy and pleased. God is good to us. I have a hardworking wife and and she treats me well. And I don't need money. Are you like that? You know, you're doing okay. You say, okay, I'm doing okay. But, you know, when I look in the paper and I see a sale on bottled water, or I see a sale on, what other nutritious things? Ice cream. Or yesterday a Cheetos sale. Oh, you know, immediately it goes off in my mind. I'll open up my hands and buy that, and then I'll hold it tight. Because that's the nature of man. We are selfish. But when we get God's perspective, when we see things from God's way, giving is just second nature. It's a joyous time. And I'm not just talking about giving a gift to your children or your grandchildren or your nieces or nephews at Christmas time. I'm talking about helping others. Paying it forward, being generous in your spirit, and giving to God in his work so that, you know, when's the last time you ever heard a preacher say, well, we have too much money, don't give any more. Just hold off for a week, we've got way more than we need. Because folks, there's a need out there. The fields are white to harvest. And God says, I need workers, we need. It's a place of giving. It's a place of teaching. Go back to Exodus 25. I should have had you put a marker there. Exodus 25 in our text that we're reading. Let them construct, verse 8. Let them construct a sanctuary for me that I might dwell there. God wanted to now be in the midst of the people. To dwell is to be in the middle, as it were. He said, this is what I want. When the company of Israel is moving, the tabernacle, the ark, all these things are in the middle of the line, protected on all sides. When you set up camp, you've got three tribes to the north, you've got three tribes to the west, three tribes to the south, three tribes to the east, right in the middle. We're going to put up this 150 by 70 foot enclosure and reassemble the tabernacle. And let people know that this is my presence. I want to be in your midst. The picture is given in verse 9 of this text, Exodus 25, verse 9. According to all that I will show you, as the pattern of the tabernacle, the pattern of all of its furnitures, just so you shall construct it. The model of the tabernacle and the furnishings are a picture of heaven. You ever wonder what the throne room of God looks like? Of the place where Jesus came to sprinkle blood after his crucifixion, he ascended up to heaven? This is what it looks like. Now, this is just an earthly temporary tent, and it's simple, but this is the pattern that Moses saw, and that this is what he was to give to the people. There were no carvings, no stained glass, no way to teach the illiterate without books like used in the churches since the time of Christ. But it's a picture that the people could understand. My little foster granddaughter, Jessica, came up to us and gave us a picture to put on our refrigerator. That's, by the way, that is a level of joy for me, to see a little child adopted in, or not quite adopted, but almost into our family. But I'm grandpa, and this is grandma. And she drew a picture of us standing. I think we were holding hands, too. Weird. And then all these little children. And we saw hers because it had big glasses on. And we could look right through there. And that was her picture. She said, I just want to remind you of us when we're not here. I wanted to tell her, you'll remind me every time I try to pay the credit card for what I've spent when you were here. But I didn't go into those details with her. But it's there on our refrigerator. Come on by. And it's amazing. That's what the tabernacle is. It's a picture, a reminder, right there in the middle of Israel, where they could teach them that God is holy and you should be holy. God said in Leviticus 11:44, I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourself. Be holy, for I am holy. I'm the Lord that brought you up out of the land of Egypt. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy. The tabernacle is a place of giving, a place of teaching, a place of serving. Now, turn to the other text in Exodus 31, a few pages over to your left. Exodus 31, we begin in the first verse, because it's a place of serving for the Lord. The Lord said to Moses, see, I've called by name Bezalel. And sometimes it's got two E's, it looks like E-L at the end of it, depending on your translation. The son of Uri, the grandson of Hur, of the tribe of Judah. I filled him with the Spirit of God, with ability and intelligence and knowledge and all craftsmanship, to devise the artistic designs, to work in gold, silver, and bronze, cutting stone, setting them, and carving wood, and working in every craft. Now, I suppose that, Bezalel would be akin to one of our master craftsmen here, to Ben, who can get a design and say, I want to make something look like a buffalo, or look like whatever is a heron. I've seen some of your pictures online. It's amazing. And he gets these things and he sculpts them out and he makes the clay and makes the mold and does the bronze or brass. And in what? Okay, so we'll be out. Okay, you come to our house, see the picture, go to their house and see bronze, big things and all the work he does there. And I could never do that. I have trouble drawing stick figures that look human. I don't have any artistic ability whatsoever. That's why I settled to be a preacher, because I couldn't do anything to make money other than that. And so here we see this man from Judah, the largest tribe, grandson of Hur. Remember Aaron and Hur that held up the arms of Moses when they were fighting with the Amalekites? His grandson, by the way, if you do the math, he was somewhere between 13 and 16 years old. Whoa. And God said, I'm putting this spirit, this way to a design and the skills in him. It's my gift to you in this young man. And he devised the plans for every part of the tabernacle and how it would all work together. And folks, if you start reading in this area of Exodus, it is fun to see what God did. You know, they didn't just make a top for the tent out of canvas. They made 11 panels of a certain fabric, and then put little hook and eye loop-de-loops up each side. Some of you ladies that do sewing would know what I'm talking about. So it would jive together in all 11, and it could pull up over the top of the tabernacle building and cover it all. And certain of them were longer so that it would form an awning over the front. Certain of them were down all the way to the ground. Others didn't come all the way to the ground and had to have cords and stakes. It's all in there. I'm reading it just going, wow, I could just spend years preaching in the tabernacle. Amen? Okay. 3 weeks. Okay. The idea here is, though, that he did God gifted him to do a work, and God did great things through him. Have you ever wished that you could be the preacher? Have you ever wished that you could get up and sing and do some wonderful performance for the Lord? A lot of people have abilities that are God-given and used by God, but they don't happen to be the same ones that I have, where I can speak and try to teach and try to lead you into understanding what God is saying. You see, the platform mentality is what everybody wants today. They want to be the guy up front. And I thought to myself, didn't John Milton, who wrote Paradise Lost and Paradise Regained and beautiful poetry back in hundreds of years ago, and then he went blind? And he wrote a little poem on his blindness. And he says, I'd like to go across the sea. I'd like to do this. I'd like to, all these different things, but I can't. And he said, and then I realized that God says they also serve who only stand and wait. You see, we need every type of person. We need the men and the women. We need the children and the elderly. We need the rich and the poor. We need every type of person, every background to form this body. But we're not all the head, or we're not all the eyes. Some of us are the thumbs. Some of us are the big toes. Some of us are just part of the body. You can read 1 Corinthians and smile with that as we recognize what we are. God gives us tasks. I think Bezalel might have wished someday he could wear the robes that he was making for Aaron and his sons as a priest. But that didn't stop him. That didn't make his work ineffective. He made the robes even more beautiful, even though he knew he would never put one on. He was doing it to serve another. When I was in college, I was in the play Macbeth, and I had to get fitted for armor and the different things that were there. And I had to go to the costume room and have this sweet young lady there working. And you know, we were in a school where you couldn't, you know, if you looked at each other cross-eyed, you got in trouble. You couldn't touch. You couldn't kiss at all, let me tell you. So when she grabbed my hand and held my hand and was working on cuffs of my garment, I was in heaven. I thought, this is good. She put a gum beard on, you know, this sticky gum thing and beard that probably looked better than the one I wear now. But, you know, on there as Banquo. And then, you know, I leaned down and I said, have you ever kissed a man with a beard? And she tried to slap at me. And I'd reach down there and she'd be working on it, and I'd brush my hand against the side of her head and her hair and just flirt around a little bit. Did you remember that, Teresa?
Sure enough.
Yeah. I still have the scar, if anyone would like to see, where she drove the sewing needle into my hand and out the other side. So I know a little bit of that feeling there. But, you know, I was in the play. She never was on stage. She never got closer than the costuming. Who was more important? People would have laughed at me if I'd have come out there in Dockers and a sweater playing, you know, Banquo from the 1100s. But they all felt I was just perfect for the role because of what she did in preparation for it. That's him. And keep reading, verse 6, 31:6. Behold, I've also appointed Aholiab, son of Ahisamach of the tribe of Dan. I've given him into all able men capability that they should make all that I've commanded you. A tent of meeting, the ark of testimony, the mercy seat on it, all the furnishings, finely worked garments, etc., etc., etc. So Aholiab was kind of the leader of the craftsmen. You got Bezalel, who is the designer, the chief architect of the whole thing, and Aholiab, who is the head of the craftsmen, who are, you know, doing the brick and mortar type work. And not from Judah, but from the weak little tribe of Dan. a tribe that later on in the kingdom, that's where Jeroboam set up a false calf to worship, a bull god, when he split the kingdom and started his own kingdom in the northern tribes. His name means the God my father is my tent. I like that. Bezalel's name means in the shadow of God, because he literally was working in the shadow of God. These are neat little things that we can learn here. But God is using people in ability, and that's the lesson that we need to learn. He not only uses our gifts and our willingness and our desires, he gives each of us different abilities, and we work together to see God's glory. Because that's what's going to happen as the tabernacle is completed and the glory of God fills this. It's a little aside note here. When Solomon is building the temple, almost 500 years later, he calls Hiram, the king of Tyre, and says, "Who do you have that can help me do the work?" And he says, "Oh, I've got Hammurabi, who is of the tribe of Dan," same tribe, "and he can do all the work." And, you know, Solomon's temple, you know, built with huge rocks and giant cedar timbers holding up the roof and so forth, a huge building compared to this. And so God uses the architect, designer, he uses the skilled craftsman here and constructs the tabernacle. And we close with this, the third point, which is simply the way God said, "I want to build this." Simple, basic, but a beautiful picture of a place separated and holy where I can live with the Jews for the next nearly 500 years. The outer court, they built sockets that were laid down out of bronze, and pillars that were made and covered with silver, and curtains between them, every 7 feet apart all the way around the tabernacle, 7.5 feet high, so no one could look in and see what was happening inside. Even the stakes were all bronze, and the sacrifices there was to come in to the tabernacle, and this would be a separate area, an area where you could worship, where you could give sacrifices, where you could be cleansed, where you can see redemption. And then the curtains themselves were made from fine twined white linen, hung on these 60 pillars all around the outside. There was only one gate that was left in there, only one way in. You can see where that's going to go for a picture of Jesus before long. And then the curtains on the inside, there was a division on the inside of the tabernacle itself that was made a 15-foot addendum, as it were, the holiest place, a 15 by 15 by 15 cube. Not very big at all, 15 feet high. And that would be where the ark was, in the place where only the high priest could go once a year. And so God did this as a place to keep it holy, pure, separated from all the people. They couldn't get near it. And then he said, "Then we're going to build the building." And this is how simple it is. I don't know if you've ever used Legos. Legos are fun, okay? I have grandkids in the Lego League, and they make all sorts of things out of Legos. If you think of laying down the foundation of this 45 by 15 foot building, and you think of Lego base, so that then you can put in vertical posts, vertical planks of wood covered with gold. You can link them all together with a rod going through the middle of them. Able to simply pull the rod out, all of the boards can be lifted out simply. Somebody lifts up each of the sockets that are, I call them Legos to my grandkids, down in the bottom all the way around. Take down the tent topping and you move. It's not that hard. As they all would work together to do this. With a wooden skeleton and then the curtains around it and on top of it, covering the walls with these fine twined linen dyed blue and purple and scarlet. Egypt was the best in the world. And who had made them in Egypt? Probably the slave Hebrew women had made them, and now they're able to do this for the temple. And so they clasped together and made this building. And then over the top of this, by the way, if you're doing this with your family for a little bit of a project, use a shoebox. Simple thing. That's the tabernacle. And then over the top of it, you put your layers. That they put, obviously, the lowest layer was this fine linen. Beautifully, intricately, I'll get it all out, made with seraphs and cherubs, seraphim and cherubim, figures in the cloth itself, so that when anyone who walked into there would look up at the ceiling, would look at the walls, they would see this beautiful reminder. This is God's place. This is where God dwells in our midst. And then they put on three more coatings over the top of this. The first layer was a curtain of black goat's hair, and then a ram skin to be a tougher, you know, cowhide type idea of it on each side. And then finally, the skin of a marine animal, which we don't know for sure because the Hebrew writer just says it's a mammal. And we're not sure what it exactly was, but most people think it was a dolphin, porpoise, seal, dugong, which is like a sea cow, that they went down at the Red Sea. All these are there. And you take them, and now what do we know about, like, the skin? Let's just say it was a seal or a porpoise or something like that. It's waterproof. It's tough. You stitch that puppy together, and it's going to come over the top of everything else, and there's no... A puppy together, that seems weird. I'm sorry. stitch the puppy together. It would protect it all. It's a beautiful, beautiful plan here. But, by the way, a bunch of skins of seal or porpoise or something over the top? That's going to be ugly. That's good, you know, it might keep everything waterproof, it might keep dust out, it might keep everything just perfect looking, but if you just looked at this from outside, no one would be intrigued, no one would say, oh, that's a beautiful place where you made for God. They wouldn't know that at all. The beautiful part was inside and hidden. The outside was just plain, homely, as it were. And God gave this to the people so they could have this place of meeting. So, in conclusion, we have this meaningful, beautiful area in the middle of the camp, reminding the Jews who are out in their lean-tos and in their tents and their Bedouin-type things, miles each direction around where the tabernacle was. It wasn't a pyramid, it wasn't a temple, it wasn't a Gothic cathedral. It was just this small little place, but every part functional, beautiful, and portable until a grand temple could be built 500 years ago, or 500 years after that, on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. But the building itself is not nearly as important as the attitude in the hearts of the people. Their spirit, their generosity, their desire to fellowship with God, their desire to follow every command, every word of God, so that they might build him this place where they could worship him, and most of all, they could know God. Its purpose was clear. Exodus 29, 43 through 46 concludes this by saying, "There I will meet with the people of Israel, and it'll be sanctified by my glory. I'll consecrate the tent of the meeting and the altar, Aaron and his sons. I'll dwell among my people Israel, and I will be their God. And they shall know that I am the Lord their God, who brought them out of the land of Egypt, that I might dwell among them. For I am Yahweh, I am the Lord their God. Next week, Lord willing, we'll pick up on the different aspect of what's in the tabernacle and how each functions in the beautiful picture of the redemption in our line of worship as we enter the tabernacle with the Jews of old.